Saturday simulcast. Tom Dienhart joins me as we will do part two of our coaches breakdown, some of our memories and stories of Purdue football coaches. We did Jack Mullenkopf through Leon Burnett last week. So if you missed that, make sure you tune in. But then we are today going to start with Fred Akers and all the way down to Jeff Brohm as well. And I want to thank our sponsor, and that's the Purdue Union Club Hotel. One of our new sponsors this year. They've got the 811 restaurant, Purdue University, up and going. Masks are on, but so far so good. It appears on campus. And, of course, this is a beautiful new facility, renovated facility, the new hotel, but also the restaurant. You have to, if you're on campus, you need to stop by. It's well worth seeing. And maybe even one of, and I know the renovated rooms too. I haven't been in those yet, but I've heard very, very good things. So we are excited to have them as sponsor. And Tom, first of all, we've got an interesting, you know, always when we break down the coaches, it's more from the stories and things that we remember about them. Fred Akers obviously did not have a successful tenure at Purdue, came to the Purdue program after being at Texas. There were a lot of high hopes for him in a certain, you know, hey, Purdue's finally got a big name coach. And yet it just didn't work out. But in terms of his tenure, interesting guy. And I've got some stories. But what are your recollections? You were in school at the time. And what were your takeaways from the Fred Akers era?
Yeah, no, you said you used to play lunchtime basketball.
Yeah, I'll talk about that in a bit. Yeah.
His staff. Yeah, the fall of 87 was my final semester of college. That was the 100th anniversary of Purdue football. I never forget that. When you were full-time, I remember there was pom-poms handed out, I think, at the Louisville game that year. Of course, Purdue tied in Louisville. That was sort of a dubious afternoon, but I digress. I just
with Danny, with Danny Hope as a GA, as I recall, but that's right. We'll talk about that in a bit.
Well, I remember I just did a what-if earlier this week on what if Purdue didn't hire Fred Akers, and we all know how it turned out, and it didn't turn out well. Very, I guess, disappointing four-year run. I always wondered how interested Fred Akers was in being in West Lafayette at Purdue. I got the feeling maybe he felt he was too good for the place and too good for the job. Just my conjecture and speculation. But what if, Alan, and this for me is the funnest what if of all, what if Purdue had gotten Ron Meyer instead?
Yeah.
Again, we all know the story there. Purdue supposedly had him sewn up, right? And then the Indianapolis Colts swept in and hired him away from Purdue. Other names that were really bandied about back then, Alan, were intriguing. Bobby Ross was at Maryland, and Bobby Ross would have been a great hire, I think. Went on to great success at Georgia Tech and with the San Diego Chargers. So, again, Fred Akers it was. You told me and others that Stephen Berrien's the one who really pushed for Fred Akers more so than George King. But again, very few bright spots, Alan. In 1988, I did cover Purdue football for the infamous Lafayette Leader. I went to every football game in 1988. Brutal season, as you know. I did see Purdue win at Ohio State, though. That's the last time.
That's unbelievable.
At Ohio State, Ernie Strahmeyer caught about 30 passes. Purdue got out of the horseshoe with a win that day. I don't know how, but they did. But again, Fred Akers, very forgettable. And I think we were all glad that Purdue moved on from him after just 4 years.
Yeah, it is an interesting story on Fred. And you're right. George King and Fred Akers never meshed in any way, shape, or form. I don't think he was George's. I know he wasn't George's choice. And I think that was a part of it, certainly. Fred was a, you're right, also really came from a big time program, very image oriented, had a lot of similarities to Daryl Hazel on that front.
Yeah.
Fred liked his picture taken a certain way. His wife Diane was a photographer and was very, very conscious about image. Not a guy that could, at least at Purdue, was not able to inspire the masses. He had some good coaches, some decent coaches around him, yeah. Phil Bennett being one of them. Some others, but just never got it off the ground. And yeah, you're right. I used to play noontime basketball with Fred we always laughed with the rest of us commoners that Fred had a creative way of keeping score. You had to really watch him, what the score was, and whether he just couldn't count or what, but you're playing to 21, Fred would sneak his points up down the stretch. But very competitive guy in the basketball court. A lot of his assistant coaches played with us as well. And, you know, he really thought that I think he could come in here and recruit. And he did one year. You know, his first year, first full recruiting class was ranked back in one of the few times that one of the only publications, USA Today, I think it was a top 25 recruiting class. And, of course, Brian Madden, Peyton Minner, Jim Schwantz, one of the better recruiting classes in the last 50 years.
Frank Kmet and Jeff Skinina and Steve Jackson.
Right, all guys that with Skinina and Jackson that were longtime NFL guys. Skinina, extremely longtime NFL guys. So they went into Chicago and did something Purdue hasn't really done since.
Bill Kolar, the assistant coach, was the real key to getting those guys, the Kmets and Schwantzes and Skininas from Chicago, the D-line coach.
Right, and we'll hit our top assistant coaches down in the upcoming issues. But my point is that Fred's offense, you know, he tried the run and shoot and just didn't work well. He had Eric Hunter, who they recruited, and Hunter came in as a freshman in 88. No, 89. Right, in 89. Brian Fox played as a 17-year-old freshman and led Purdue to a win at Ohio State and then transferred to Florida. So he had some talent in there. It just didn't mesh. He came in his first press conference and we call it the barn that Fred built, but the Mullenkopf Athletic Facility, you know, George King, they announced that situation at his opening press conference. So he knew what big time football looked like and brought a lot of that Texas feel, but it just didn't translate well to West Lafayette. So, and the offense was stagnant, and the fans went south. There was nobody left when he left. Not good. The 88 team, really hard to watch offensively. The 89 team, very much that case, Calvin Williams aside, and maybe at times at the end, Eric Hunter and that great upset that kept Fred Akers for another year, which was the win at Indiana in 89. But you got back to 1990 and Purdue had a chance to compete, did compete well against Washington, the season opener, but just never got enough momentum to keep him around. And the fan base lost confidence in him. And when that happens, as you know, Tom, it's over. And for whatever reason, but interesting.
Around the run and shoot offense, 1990, Purdue's leading rusher was Tony Vinson. He led Purdue with 198 yards rushing on the year. And get this, Alan, in Akers' 4 years, Purdue had four rushing touchdowns total.
Yeah, unbelievable. They just could not run the football. And I felt bad. You almost felt bad for them. The games were very painful to watch because you went in. It was the first time, my first experience really of going into Ross-Ade Stadium with no chance to – feeling like you had no chance to win. And that was a hard thing. And Purdue moved on from Fred, one of the best, craziest press conferences I've ever been to in 1980 when Fred said goodbye. You don't do that anymore. But Fred left, resigned, fired, I guess. I don't think he resigned. I think he was fired. But Phil Bennett comes in and steals that press conference and gets up and kind of goes after, wasn't told about this. And he and George King who were very similar personalities, Phil Bennett and George King. Phil being the defensive coordinator, didn't like the decision, didn't like his perception of the transparency. That was fireworks. That was as much fireworks as I can ever remember. Didn't know how that was going to end, but George dealt with that and moved on. And they moved on to who? Jim Coletto. And it's interesting when you hire coaches, and we've seen this pattern at a lot of places. Tom, you've seen it more than I, but you tend to hire the guy that is kind of completely different than the one you had. And Jim Coletto was a no holds barred working man's coach, no frills.
Yeah,
he'd wore that stocking cap on the sidelines. He'd look pissed off, for lack of a better term, throughout the course of the game, mad at his players, mad at himself.
Yeah.
And yet Purdue got better for a while. And I think you could argue that the program did improve. He left it in a better place. But again, in 6 years. He was never able to get the program completely off the ground. Had a couple good wins in there, but wins at Iowa early on, and where it looked like he might be able to get some momentum, but it just didn't go in the direction that he wanted. What do you recall from old Jimmy C?
Yeah, the red-faced Jim Coletto on the sidelines, always berating people. I remember talking to you even back during that era, Alan. We talked a few times, and you were working in hockey, and you always talked about Coletto's sideline demeanor and the negative aura he would project just by body language, yeah. How you carry yourself. And, you know, you go through tough times, but you got to maintain a certain image. And Coletto had a hard time controlling his emotions and staying calm under duress when things weren't going well. And I think sometimes that reflects and rubs off on your troops to a degree. So, like you said, though, a very passionate guy, a football guy to the core, right? True X's and O coach who actually, as you know, was the offensive coordinator at Purdue for Leon Burtonette and Jim Everett and those offenses that were so prolific. So, Coletto seemed like a personality fit for Purdue, but again, just couldn't get the program over the edge. Didn't have one winning season, Alan. But you know what? One thing that was revealed to us was he was a better recruiter than I think a lot of us thought. We saw what Joe Tiller did with a lot of that talent that Coletto brought in, Alan. Those first 4 years, the Joe Tiller era that we all love so much, those 4 years were pretty much all fueled by Jim Coletto players. Now, credit to Joe Tiller and his staff for making those players better. But again, there was talent in West Lafayette that Jim Coletto brought. Mike Allstott, you know, we talked about Corey Rogers, Matt Light, Chuck Jacoby, Brandon Gorin, defensively, Roosevelt Colvin, Chike O'Keefer, Chuki Nwokorie, David Nugent, Willie Fells, all Jim Coletto guys. So again, he was a pretty solid recruiter, but as we know, really couldn't get it done on the field on Saturdays.
Yeah, and again, you're right. No, he was passionate. He never called me. I know he called one of our former writers, Kevin Keckler, when he was at the Exponent, and just ripped Kevin. He was passionate about, you know, thinking about being treated fair. And I always liked Jim from that perspective. He was a kind of a Purdue fit in mm-hmm. that light. But again, that body language thing in today's world, for the most part, he was kind of Gene Cady-esque in some ways, but there was just a difference. And he just didn't have enough success, and that may have been some of his own. And he did some things as a coach that really rankled the fan base. A couple of games going for ties against Iowa and Michigan State late that they kind of left the fans left the building. And, you know, one of the great stories in 1996, Purdue beats Michigan 9-3, unbelievably, against number 9 ranked Michigan. Purdue was kind of in the tank at that point, and Coletto had resigned that Monday after. He was so flamboozled after losing to Wisconsin at 33-25 the week before. He resigns on a Monday radio show. Never seen anything like it. You won't see that again that way. And then he beats Michigan. And I think, though I've never heard it, and sadly we can't ask Morgan directly, though Morgan probably still wouldn't have commented on it, but supposedly asked for his job back. And of course, Joe Tiller was, they were in the works for Bob Davey and then ended up getting Joe Tiller. And that was Katie bar the door. But Jim Coletto, passionate guy, offensive lineman mentality, UCLA guy, California guy, actually, brought some passion. And I would argue, historically, history is correct. He improved the program, and you just needed the better conduit, the better motivator, maybe a better, different type of staff. I don't know if it's better, but they were different. The new faces came in, and all of a sudden we go to Joe Tiller. And we would probably ought to do our own. We'll do our own podcast on the history of Joe Tiller. But give me some remarks on his 12-year tenure, and it was a remarkable one in many, many ways.
Yeah, real quick, one last footnote on Coletto for fans. My favorite Jim Coletto game was that 59-56 loss at Minnesota.
Yeah,
in 1993. That was epic. Yeah, Joe Tiller, my gosh. Yeah, like you said, we could just devote an entire podcast to him. A convergence of the perfect forces, Alan. Basketball on grass, offense comes into the plotting Big Ten. They're not ready for it. And, you know, that was big. And defenses in the Big Ten didn't know how to respond to it. And we saw that success manifest itself in that first season in 1997 for Joe Tiller. So, again, he really changed the Big Ten from a passing standpoint. People didn't think you could throw the ball in the Big Ten in the bad weather. Well, Tiller did it in Wyoming. Laramie, Wyoming has very adverse weather. So Tiller certainly knew he could do it in West Lafayette. He had been here before as a defensive coordinator for Leon Burnett. And, he just did a great job. That offense set the tone, and off and away he went to one of the most glorious runs in Purdue history.
Yeah, and again, we'll deal with the Tiller era a little bit more down the road. But, yeah, I think the thing that the position switches were key, setting the tone. He came in and toughened them up a little bit. While Coletta was a tough guy, I don't think they had as much discipline. You know, the famed February workouts were legendary there. I think he was hard on those guys, especially early in his career, maybe not as much late. And Joe was a CEO guy, too. I think he knew how to delegate. He had some very good assistants on his staff. You know, you can argue Jim Chaney and Greg Olson and Tim Lapano early on, that guys that, you know, I know Jim Chaney is a conversation piece all along, though I love Jim Chaney myself and thought he was great. But my point is that they put the right pieces together. And I think that was a big thing, being able to recognize it. And I would always argue, in the history of Purdue football, Tom, when does Purdue win? It wins when it has a better mousetrap. And when it has an offense you can't defend, when it has a, you know, they couldn't defend the bubble screen early on. They couldn't defend the West Coast presentation that that Joe Tiller brought. And Joe Tiller, I remember, and I've said this before, I think 97 or 98, Joe would tell you to call it like he saw it, and you could have off-the-record conversations with him, which we enjoyed. And he said, there'll be a day here at Purdue where they don't love me like they do now, and this is a tough place to win. Yeah. And he was always trying to get more for his program. He struggled at times with administration on that front. But Joe Tiller also was very – very bright, saw what the future would bring, and saw that they would figure out his defense or his offense at some point in time, and they did. And mm-hmm. and Purdue adjusted a little bit, but by the end of his tenure, it was everybody in the Big Ten was doing it. And I think you go back down in history of the Big Ten, Tom, and Joe Tiller will be one of those guys that will be talked about as the guy that changed the face of the league. And I think that's offensively, he brought it in, and Purdue just happened to be a couple steps ahead. And they had a guy in Billy Dickin that was all Big Ten level, but also a guy named Drew Brees that could run that offense better than anybody in the world. And I think that all played into it. But, you know, Tiller was captured the imagination of the fans. He started fast, and there's nothing hotter than new love, so to speak. And we've talked about the 97 season about, you know, Tiller talked about it being Christmas every week. It just is nothing like it. It's kind of a little bit like 2017 was, not quite to that level in 17, but, you know, then 18, when you have a guy like Rondale Moore, there's just nothing like it, you know, from a fan's perspective. Well, Tiller had that same thing there, and obviously got Purdue to the Rose Bowl, maybe had his best team in 2003. We'll talk about that at another time, but yeah, it really did capture the imagination of fans.
Talked about building a better mousetrap. That's when Purdue's at its best. And that was a knock on, not to go back to Coletta, but Jim Coletta was trying to be Ohio State at Purdue. Physical offense, you're not going to get better players and run that offense better than Michigan and Ohio State. Like you said, Tiller had the innovative offense. Definite arc to his career, Alan. First 4 years, boy, what a blast. Peak talent the second 4 years. Maybe didn't quite achieve expectations. A lot of fun games, fun teams, great players. And in the last 4 years, Alan, I think you would agree with me, were disappointing to a degree. And honestly, the program's never really picked up from there since the I hate to bring up the Orton fumble. That's always the point people reference the day Purdue football, I'm not going to say died, but really started to struggle. And honestly, it has not gained any momentum since that 2004 team was started 6-0 and didn't really finish the deal that year.
Yeah, I think it's certainly a struggle. Certainly, you can argue in 17 and 18 that with the emergence of a Rondale Moore and with the surprise of 17 that you've got the fans back and certainly started in the right direction. But sustaining that level, that's still what Jeff Brohm's trying to get done. But yeah, that is a true statement. And it was hard for Tiller down the stretch as well, just because we always talk about this aging coaches. It was hard for Gene Katie when it's getting near the end of your time and somebody tells you that it's your time or your time is up. And I think that happened to Joe after the 2007 season. And I don't think I think Joe would have liked to have coached to 2009. In fact, I know that. He feels like his team would have won in 2009, but that's, you know, and I don't know all the facts on that, but I do think that that's a factor. But
staff turnover you talked about too, Alan. He couldn't keep his assistant coaches. That really hurt him too.
After initially, you know, remember Joe Tiller had a deal where he had to, you know, initially that he wanted his guys to stay 3 years. They did, but you know, for whatever reason, they weren't competitive financially, and guys like Bob DeBess and Greg Olson. Now Olson went to the NFL, so it's a little bit hard to compare. Yeah, guys got better.
Kevin Sumlin left.
Right, better opportunities and better financial situations, and that, you know, that's something that I know that Mike Babinski has tried to do with the Jeff Brohm staff, is make sure that you have the resources to keep the guys you want there. And yeah, that still is a struggle. You know, it still is a struggle to this day. All right, we'll move on now to Danny Hope, and of course the transition. was an interesting one in terms of that. You know, Purdue Morgan Burke announced, you know, like he did with Gene Katie to Matt Painter, he did the same thing from Joe Tiller to Danny Hope. Danny, a different guy from that standpoint. Joe's offensive line coach, an extremely good offensive line coach, had some success at Eastern Kentucky, was the head coach. That's what attracted Morgan Burke to him at the end of the day. And Danny came in and did some good things early on, though he did and did not. They started at 1-5 in 2009. They beat Ohio State, the seventh-ranked Ohio State, in one of the great upsets in week 7, and a team that had some talent, and then just never got it going enough there. Fan base kind of left, and we were left to kind of a similar situation with other past coaches. But you're and yet Danny Hope, extremely passionate, a football guy. He was absolutely that. Just couldn't get it done consistently at Purdue.
Yeah, you're exactly right. Good summation, Alan. The ultimate football guy. I always think of that, wearing the baseball cap backward.
Yeah.
He poured himself into Purdue football. Danny Hope pours himself into whatever he's doing, I think. And very passionate and very intense, tremendous work ethic, and wants to succeed badly. There's no ever doubting, you know, what he brought to the table from a work ethic standpoint. Was a solid recruiter too. I thought he did a pretty good job, but you know, on Saturdays that just didn't come to fruition for Danny Hope, and he never really had that sustained success that so many people of us hoped for. And you talked about the 2009 team, Danny Hope's first, and you know, that was a team quarterbacked by Joey Elliott that should, for all intents and purposes, have been a bowl team, and it wasn't. You talked about the rough start. They won their opener, then they lost like four or five in a row. That loss at Oregon, Alan, second game of the year, was killer in 2009. So yeah, it was unfortunate. I didn't think Danny Hope always had the best staffs. That certainly, I don't think, augmented his chances for success. But again, no denying his passion and wanting to succeed, but it just didn't happen on Saturdays.
Yeah, it didn't. And I think again, we get back to that first couple games. I always struggle with the, you know, the Oregon game was a tremendous opportunity. Purdue had to win Oregon, and they ended up giving two scoops and scores, or pick sixes, I believe, the Ducks. And Purdue really had a chance to win that game, and that could have changed the whole thing, as could have a couple of weeks later against Notre Dame and the famed decision to call timeout late in that game that gave Charlie Weiss and the Irish a chance. And it wasn't, and I've said this many times, and I don't, and it's, you never know unless you're on the sidelines. It's, so it's a little unfair to judge totally what his thought process was there. But the problem was, in my opinion, with Danny was that, that he just didn't let it go. In other words, he should have, at the post-game press conference, he spent a lot of time in the next week kind of proving to others, hey, this was the right call, and I would make it again 100 times. And sometimes when you admit, hey, I'm not 100% sure, it's a catch-22, and I get that. But I thought Danny was always struggled at times with perception by media, perception that others, he was the consummate underdog. You know, Danny Hope grew up not in a wealthy environment as a kid. He was a street fighter. And his, that's why his offensive line loved him. If you ask Matt Light and Brandon Gorin and Chucky Okobe, they all love Danny Hope, and they should, because he's their street fighter. They'd get in practice, and he would, and if there was a fight that broke off in practice with the offensive line, this is in his Hope's day under Tiller, he'd get in fight with him. You know, that was Danny. And, but I think as a head coach, it made it tough for him, I think, from a focus standpoint. And I think Danny also suffered from a time where resources weren't up to snuff. And that's not, you know, that, you know, I'm not going to pin that on Morgan Burke at all necessarily, but it, for whatever reason, you know, Purdue got a little bit behind the eight ball. You know, Danny Hope was probably the last coach, one of the last coaches in the history of the Big Ten to make under $1 million a year. And I think all those factors tied into a difficult career. And yet, you know, his teams, even in his in 2012, right, they had a chance to beat Ohio State. They were up 8 at Ohio State down the stretch. And all those factors make him interesting. He could get his teams ready to go because of that street fighter mentality. You know, his offenses with under Gary Nord could throw it a little bit, but just a lack of continuity. So a disappointing and yet not shocking, because then you go to Daryl Hazel, and again, as we talked about how administration sometimes works, you tend to hire the guy that's the exact opposite of Danny Hope. You know, Danny Hope wore his cap backwards. Daryl Hazel was a three-piece, or not three-piece, but a beautiful, wore great-looking suits, very well put together, that type of guy, and came in very, very, you know, very well-spoken. Not that Danny Hope wasn't, but Danny was a little Paul Bear Bryant-ish, and Daryl Hazel came in very polished, with a pedigree that led you to believe that you could have some success.
Yeah, boy, you said it perfectly, Alan. I still wonder at some point here after Tiller, what would happen if our guy Brock Speck would have got a shot. But yeah. I don't want to get off on that.
That's another podcast, but I'm with you on that. I wish, in retrospect, I think if you hire Brock Speck in 2008 as a transition, you'd at least stayed afloat. That's my view.
When that all went down, when that story broke, Tom Kubot was getting, he had some great source, I remember. And I heard from a lot of Purdue assistant coaches who were stunned, but I don't want to go there. Daryl Hazel. Yeah. Like I said, you talked at the top of the podcast, how Fred Akers was image conscious. You mentioned Daryl Hazel then. Yes. Very image conscious. I guess he had some big notorious handbook, didn't he?
The eight players manual.
Yeah, there you go. So, and you talked about how he would spend Sundays in his office by himself watching special teams film. I don't know. You know, there was always seemed to be something dubious about Daryl Hazel. There was never a connection. There's never seemed to be a real authenticity to the guy. Always a veneer. Very, very nice person. Very friendly. Very engaging, but again, it just didn't seem to be authentic, I guess. And again, he was an Ohio State guy, Alan. And I think he tried to, apply a lot of the Jim Tressel model that he learned under in West Lafayette at Purdue. And that's not going to work. You got to think outside that box if you want to have success at Purdue. So it was just an abysmal era. Let's not sugarcoat it. I think we all knew after 1 year, probably wasn't going to go anywhere. I was shocked when he came back for a fourth year. Honestly, Alan, I can't think of one positive thing to say about the Daryl Hazel era.
Yeah, Daryl, you're right. Daryl could not have been a nicer person. I think he's had the ability as a position coach. I think it's tough. You know, might have been tough for an African American to come in a situation, though I don't think there was any situation that from a racial standpoint that counted against him. But I just think it's tough, and just being the person that he was. Again, kind of a quiet guy, kind of a reclusive to some extent. And, you know, his Sundays, I know his Sundays was really kind of spent, whether it was watching special teams or watching game film, he just didn't feel like the rest of the staff. And this could have been wrong because I was not in the room, certainly, but you just didn't feel like there was that great connection to get stuff figured out. Purdue didn't do stuff that was tactically incorrect. Typically, but they weren't in enough games to really have that matter. They never played a game under Daryl Hazel where you had to make all the right decisions at crunch time, I think, in his entire career. You know, they had a couple wins. They beat Illinois a couple times on the road. I can remember in 2014, there was a glimmer of hope with Austin Appleby coming in and running the offense and winning in Illinois, which was a little bit of a surprise. There was a glimmer of hope briefly there that things could turn around. I remember Danny Anthrop doing very, very well. And I remember Danny Anthrop hurting his knee, I think it was in 14, at Nebraska, and it just went south, and it never came back. And, you know, Daryl Hazel, there's no other way to say it. It was, you know, it was difficult, consistent with Fred Akers. You don't want to be bad and boring at the same time. The offenses weren't fun to watch. They tried to power football enough or do some things that just didn't make a lot of sense. And that really was hard. And it was hard too because, yes, Purdue opened up the pocketbook to some extent to hire Daryl Hazel compared to what they paid for Danny Hope. But there were still some constraints there. And at the end of Hazel's career, it was clear that not only the Board of Trustees, but that the pocketbook was going to be opened up some. And there you go. You get Jeff Brohm. And you spend some money to do that. You spend some money on the staff. You spend some money on a lot of money on the facilities. We know what situation we're in now with the pandemic. But you bring in a Jeff Brohm, and I think that we'll see. The Jeff Brohm era certainly has had an uptick. I don't think there's – even with last year's four wins, Purdue is a much better program, much more competitive on the recruiting trail. I think it's still to be determined where Jeff Brohm takes this program, and unfortunately we're not going to see it in the 2020 season, at least in the fall. There's still some work to be done. He knows that as well. If he were sitting here, he'd be saying the same thing. But Jeff Brohm certainly was – there was definitely with Mike Babinski and company – an investment in football, and that's what we're going to find out. And he does the one thing that I think that I like with Tiller. There's a little bit of a better mousetrap, certainly not necessarily with an offense that people haven't seen before, but with an attitude at times of, hey, we're going to do crazy things when we're going to go to play to win. And we saw more of that in 17 and 18 than we did in 19. There are reasons for that. There were injuries, et cetera. And I get all that. And the trick play stuff kind of caught up with Purdue in 19, just because they, you know, couldn't generate the offense it needed to do it in certain situations. So those are all interesting factors, but Jeff Brohm will be an interesting, it's still a story to be told. I think it's clearly a step in the right direction, and how far and what it gets to when we're having the discussion in 2025, if we're all doing this, then will be an interesting one.
The planet will have been taken over by then, Alan.
Yeah, maybe.
You know, Daryl Hazel, three quick points. I remember the crowds were abysmal, like I'd never seen in my life. The staff, Alan, I was always told that he couldn't even build his own staff. And there, see, Morgan Burke was the one who tabbed Greg Hudson and John Shoup to be the coordinators. I'm not sure if that was ever true. And the inability to recruit, Alan, the NFL draft tells all, right?
Yeah.
In 2017, 18, 19, and 20, Purdue's had, I think, three players drafted total. D'Angelo Yancey, Juwan Bentley, nobody in 19 got picked. Last year, he had Marcus Bailey, right? Those are all Daryl Hazel's guys. He's had three NFL draft picks from all those players that he signed. Maybe Lorenzo Neal will get drafted. I don't know, but my point is there was no recruiting bump at all with Daryl Hazel. I always heard that his recruiting was dubious as well. So, unfortunate. We talked about Brohm. That's the positive, Alan. I do think, just from my personal standpoint, when I watch Purdue play, I feel confident, Alan. I feel confident in that staff. I think most Saturdays Purdue has a schematic advantage because the guy wearing the headset for Purdue. I can't say I felt that way until back to the Joe Tiller era. But I honestly feel that, hey, this staff has a clue. This staff's going to give Purdue a great chance to win. I think they can out coach these guys. And to me, that's what it's all about. And you talked about recruiting, the lifeblood of everything we know. And we've seen that play out in some fine recruiting classes by Jeff Brohm's already assembled the first 3+ years here.
Yeah, and I would do a comparison. I tend to oversimplification. He's got a lot of that. He and Matt Painter are similar in terms of that kind of one-track mind approach towards – I mean, Matt Painter, who turned 50 on Thursday, you know, he's got other things in his life, but he's a basketball guy and makes no mistake about it. And Jeff Brohm is that with respect to football. It's one-track mind. It's a football family of royalty from Louisville. Yep. And I think they get this is what they do. This is who they are. And he makes no bones about it. And I think too, the interesting thing, which is always kind of interesting, is he's got the reputation of being a player's coach. He can be tough minded. We know that. We've seen that personally. But by the same token, he is a guy that I think kids want to play for. I think the jury's still out only because last year it's tough when you have an injury-filled season, almost unprecedented. And for the first time, you know, the Penn State game, as I recall last year, was probably the only game that you went into because of the injuries at quarterback, and I think it was Plummer's first start. The only game he went into, he said, they got no chance. Other than that, this is the team that's come in with the opportunities to win, and that is the Jeff Brohm mantra. To be determined, but I think the direction generally is favorable. And I know it's hard for that staff to have to sit back in 2020 because they thought they had a lot to prove this year and they thought they could prove it. They would have had a tough schedule. We've talked about that. But there was an opportunity to really, you know, with David Bell and Rondale Moore, all these things that make you crazy if you're a Purdue fan that you're not going to see this year. And even a quarterback, some interesting, can he mold a quarterback in his own image and make that quarterback great? You know, whether that's Jack Plummer, whether these are some of the guys he's recruited down the road will tell the story of the success level that Jeff Brohm gets to.
True. Yeah, well said. Like I said, it's a fun story. It's going to it'll be a fun story to watch unfold before our very eyes. A lot of reason for optimism that you talked about, Alan. The roster has as much talent that it's had in over a decade. Talked about the staff. There's a plan there. They know how to win. We've seen tangible success on the field. He can show that to recruits. You know, nothing impresses people more than actual results. And Jeff Brohm has already proven that he can get results at Purdue with what he does. So, hey, you know, it's going to be fun to watch the next few years unfold to see if he can get Purdue back on track and compete for that Big Ten West title and more.
Right. You know, we'll go back to that October night in 2018 and one of the great nights in the history of Purdue football and the Tyler Trent game. That is proof of what can happen. Mm-hmm. And yet, Jeff Brohm, again, if you – sitting here would say it, we got to develop that consistency. We got to show, we got to have a program. We got to have an offensive line. We've got to have the things that can take you into Wisconsin and beat a Wisconsin or beat, you know, those kind of things. He's yet to get there. When he took this job too, and that's the other thing, a last comment I'll make. I felt like after the 16th season, I said it could be 6 years before they have a winning season. I mean, I've really felt that. 5 or 6 years till he redoes it. And he wins in the first year, wins games in 17. And that was impressive. I think that got everybody's attention, got the fan base back. I said there'd be 5 years till they have a sellout. Well, they had a sellout, and I think the second or third home game, he did a great job of getting fan interest back. So that's part of the puzzle, and we'll watch that story. So next week, we will talk our best offensive assistant coaches, and we've talked about a couple of them today. Recruiting, position work, we'll look back over the last 50 years, and it'll be an interesting conversation because I have yet to formulate some real strong opinions. You know a lot of these assistant coaches over the years as they've moved on. It'll be an interesting conversation. Tom, have a great week. Have a great West weekend. Parting shot, anything else that you want to add that I didn't get?
No, I think you summed it up well, Alan. Always fun to review history and relive memories, and I don't think we solved any of the world's problems, but we had some fun. No. Hopefully the viewers enjoyed it.
Yep, the fall of 2020, there's going to be a lot of that as we are on indefinite hold for the college football season. All right, have a great weekend, all. I want to thank our sponsor, the Purdue Union Club Hotel and the 811 Restaurant. They're doing a great job in a pandemic to make that a very comfortable place for you if you happen to come to campus, a safe and comfortable place, great environment. I've even been to the restaurant a couple times, great spot. It is a wonderful facility for Purdue University. And if you're a Purdue graduate or Purdue fan or a parent of a Purdue student, you'll be a place that you'll like to call home. So, all right, have a great week, everybody. And we'll look forward to next week in our Saturday simulcast. Take care, everybody.